This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, now offering Peaberry Especial, a blend of rare pea berries from Colombia, New Guinea, and Tanzania. For a limited time at Pete's retail stores or on the web at Pete's.com.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delga.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a monument is being proposed to honor former Gresham Mayor Dr. Herbert Hughes, despite his alleged involvement with an anti-Japanese group during World War II.
An Oregon City judge formally sentenced serial killer Dayton Leroy Rogers, a.k.a. the Malala Forest Killer, to death today.
John Foster, a University of Oregon professor of sociology, has been labeled one of the 101 most dangerous academics in America.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq. As of today, there have been 2,302 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 32,000 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 7th, 2006. I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner.
And I'm Doug Guidi.
John Foster, a University of Oregon professor of sociology, has been labeled one of the 101 most dangerous academics in America by conservative commentator and author David Horowitz, who released a book in February that profiles, quote, dangerous academics across the county. Foster declined to comment. Horowitz spoke at the university in 2003, condemning the institution for what he says was its effort to indoctrinate students with a leftist ideology. He also accused faculty of employing a ruthless blacklist that stifles conservative faculty and viewpoints. A coalition of student, faculty, and civil liberty groups calling itself the Free Exchange on Campus is taking a stand against Horowitz's book, calling the book a blacklist, and saying the book is part of a movement to limit the speech of American academics.
The Texas Pacific buyout of Portland General Electric failed last year, in part because of the work of Dan Meek had done with the Utility Reform Project. These days, Meek is working to finalize the settlement to get back millions of dollars for PGE ratepayers in Multnomah County. In an interview with Lisa Loving of KBOO, Meek explains how the manipulation of income taxes makes utility companies attractive to corporations in search of more money.
I am working to finalize the settlement agreement with Portland General Electric to get back $10 million for PGE ratepayers in Multnomah County, which represents the amount that they have been charged from the Multnomah County business income tax by PGE over the last 8 or 9 years since the takeover by Enron, which money was actually never paid to the county. And so we've quantified that at about $7.5 million, and we filed a class action lawsuit against PGE over a year ago. And after various court rulings in our favor during the past year, PGE agreed to give back all of the money plus interest, and there may even be some money left over for charitable purposes at the end, $3 million a year higher than they would otherwise be. In the last session of the Oregon legislature, there was a very curious, unusual coalition of forces that came together in order to pass Senate Bill 408, which is the bill that forbids utilities, as of the first of this year, from charging ratepayers for income taxes that don't actually get paid. It turns out that this is something that not only PGE has been doing, but the other utilities in Oregon have been doing as well, Pacific Power and Light in particular. That is, when it comes to setting their rates, the Oregon Public Utility Commission allows them to assume in the rates that they are paying their full freight when it comes to federal and state income taxes. That is, they simply take their expected net income, add to that 34% to pay federal income taxes, and they add to that 6.5% to pay state income taxes. So we're actually in our rates not only paying all of the costs of the utilities, including their exorbitant executive salaries and all of their other costs, but we're also paying for them to obtain a certain level of net income, their reasonable return on investment. But we're also paying for the assumed income taxes that would be paid on that return on investment. That's the number that for PGE was about $93 million a year, and for Pacific Power and Light in Oregon is about $80 million a year. But the PUC, despite my complaints there now for the past 3 years, has never actually examined what the utilities pay in income taxes. So this estimate is not based on anything that's real. They never look at their income tax returns. In fact, they still to this date have never asked the utilities how much they have actually paid in income taxes in any year, except they were required to do so by Senate Bill 408, and they still have not required the utilities to comply with Senate Bill 408, even though the deadline for the first report was last October 15th. Now, those reports remain secret. Now, the reason this is becoming a more important issue is because utilities, over the past several years, many of them have been purchased and become part of conglomerates, corporate conglomerates. The most, of course, infamous case is PGE becoming part of Enron. Enron had about 400, at least 400 subsidiaries, 400 of subsidiary or affiliate corporations. Many of them were created in tax havens like the Cayman Islands or Bermuda or elsewhere. Enron is one example of they bought a utility. They bought PGE and its cash flow. PGE had has retail cash flow in Oregon of about $1.3 billion a year. And Enron, at the same time, knew that it could avoid paying income taxes on basically any amount of cash flow by creating phony tax scams in the Cayman Islands and elsewhere. It was the Republican Senate Finance Committee that in late 2002 came out with a report that Enron was probably the biggest tax scam in U.S. history. So it was happening not only with PGE but with other utilities being bought up by international conglomerates that can manipulate their tax filings so that essentially a company with large cash flow like a utility is much more valuable to them because the cash will come into them, at least in Oregon. And not only will they get their regulated return on investment in Oregon, they will get a super bonus, this 40% bonus return, consisting of assumed income taxes that they know they won't pay. So that's one of the major reasons why utilities are being bought up by larger corporations with operations elsewhere in the world that can basically create phony tax dodges and charge in rates for assumed income taxes that are actually never paid.
That was Lisa Loving, KBOO News. Providence Health System says data thieves have struck again. The healthcare company says in late February and early March, burglars broke into cars used by nurses and stole laptops containing the records of 122 hospice and home care patients in Washington State's Snohomish County. The latest thefts are much smaller than the one disclosed in January, but Providence officials say they're frustrated. Despite training, the employees weren't following a rule that says they must keep computers in sight at all times. Instead, they left computers in their cars, once to visit a patient, another time to run into a store. Providence says it's begun encrypting the daily records that nurses keep, and it plans to provide free identity and credit assistance to every affected patient.
The deadline for filing is today, and recruiters for Oregon's political parties say they're having a hard time finding candidates for the legislature. The problems? Long sessions, partisanship, frustration about unsolved problems, and low pay. This year, 60 House seats and 15 Senate seats are up for grabs. As the deadline approached, nearly half the districts had only one candidate running. Most of the time, that's the incumbent. Gresham City Council President Shane Bemis says he decided not to run for the legislature 2 years ago because the job took too much time for too little pay. What's worse, he says, is that it's difficult to get bipartisan work done in the legislature.
A subcommittee of an Oregon Legislative Commission is suggesting breaking legislative sessions into two parts and limiting the session to 120 days. Under the proposal, legislators would convene as usual in January to appoint committees, pick leadership, pre-file bills, deal with vetoes, and handle other housekeeping matters. Then they would stand down, possibly until April, to give members time to do research and become familiar with the issues they would be voting on later. The session would end at 120 days, something that has not happened in Oregon since 1959. Marjorie Taylor, administrator for the Public Commission on the Legislature, said it was not determined how long the first part of the session would be or whether it would count towards the 120 days. She said the concept would be taken up by the full commission on April 12th and that if it is approved, it would be part of its final report to the legislature.
A proposed monument honoring former Gresham Mayor Dr. Herbert Hughes is on the town's city council agenda tonight. KABU's Sheila Whiteside has more.
Doc Hughes was beloved by many, but the proposed statue in his honor is a point of contention. That's because Hughes was also apparently a former director of the Oregon Anti-Japanese Society during World War II. The organization opposed allowing people of Japanese ancestry to return to their Gresham area homes during the war. Mayor of Gresham from 1941 to 1956, Hughes was already honored for decades with an official Dr. Hughes Day, commemorating the date of his retirement from city government. In 2003, as the city considered renaming a park for Hughes, an old newspaper clipping surfaced that listed his participation with the Anti-Japanese Society. John Kodachi, president of the Portland chapter of the Japanese American Citizens League, said yesterday that while anti-Japanese sentiment was common at the time, Hughes, quote, took it to a different level. The head of Gresham's Historic Resources Council Advisory Committee, which is proposing the memorial, disagrees with Kodachi. They argue that Hughes' association with the group was brief, that his contributions outweigh any perceived missteps, and that a new effort to honor his service with a monument should move forward. The advisory committee chair says he spent 2 months in 2003 researching Hughes' involvement with the anti-Japanese group. The chair says he could find only one reference to Hughes in newspaper stories about the group and local residents who remember the heiress say they could not remember Hughes being anti-Japanese. The chair speculated that Hughes turned away from the anti-Japanese movement as it turned increasingly bitter. Japanese residents were not sought out for input during the review for Hughes' monument. The council is scheduled to vote on the monument at 7 tonight as part of the consent agenda. That typically includes items approved without debate. For KABU News, I'm Sheila Whiteside.
A July rally planned at the Washington State Capitol in Olympia is putting local government leaders in a tizzy. That's because the rally host is a brand new Washington State chapter of the National Socialist Movement, also known as the Nazis. The group has spread thousands of flyers through the urban area of Thurston County, whipping up hatred against minority groups and promoting the July rally. When eight of the neo-Nazis had the group's first demonstration in Olympia in January, they drew a crowd of 200 counter-protesters. The local Anti-Defamation League, one of several watchdog groups tracking the neo-Nazi organization, says the group is growing. Watchdog groups are warning South Sound residents not to be lured into violent clashes with the group. However, activists also caution against ignoring the group. Complacency, they say, is one of the reasons Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, became a stronghold for the now-defunct white supremacist group Aryan Nations.
The current time is 5:15, and now, daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
How much is enough? How about $439 billion? That's how much the Pentagon wants to take out of our pockets for next year's budget. Well, you say, they're fighting a war. Yes, but the $439 billion does not count fighting wars. Those cost extra. How much extra? Well, they say they don't know. To continue what Donnie Rumsfeld now is calling the Long War, the Bushites just keep coming back to Congress and saying, more. They're asking for another $65 billion this year. This makes the fourth time in 3 years that they've demanded supplemental money to, quote, stay the course in Bush's Iraq adventure. This year's demand is on top of the $241 billion in supplemental funds they've already thrown into Iraq, a war costing our nation $100,000 a minute. For what? Iraq is a mess, quickly falling into civil war, while our men and women are dying there. Here at home, our precious Bill of Rights is tattered and torn in the name of Bush's war of lies. Meanwhile, Bush and Congress are cutting back on funding for food stamps and health care for poor children, shortchanging the restoration effort on our Gulf Coast, and ignoring our country's critical infrastructure needs, using war spending as their rationale for not doing what should be done for our own people. How much is enough? Bush's Pentagon budget is larger than the world's next 18 biggest military spenders combined. Yet it still skimps on armor, pay, and benefits for our troops. Instead, the money is going to military contractors who are producing hugely expensive planes, submarines, and other weapon systems that aren't needed or don't work, but have become massive profit centers for these corporations. This is Jim Hightower saying, tell the Congress that enough is enough. Sign True Majority's online petition. It's easy. Just go to truemajority.org. That's truemajority.org. Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Miley Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
Stay tuned for independent Native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear This Way Out. At 6:30, hear Prison Pipeline with host Reggae Bob. At 7, it's Amanda's Jam Corner with Amanda Genus. Now for weather in Portland. Outside the KBOO studios, our fruit trees are in full bloom. Considerable cloudiness tonight with occasional rain showers and a low of 41 degrees. Chance of rain is 70%. Tomorrow, expect periods of rain with a high of 46 degrees. For Hood River, mostly cloudy tonight with a few showers, low of 36 degrees. Tomorrow, rain and snow showers in the morning, changing to just rain in the afternoon. 44 degrees will be the high, and chance of precipitation is 100%. And in Corvallis tonight, considerable cloudiness with occasional rain showers, high of 42 degrees. Tomorrow, windy and rainy, with a chance of precipitation at 100%. And winds at 20 to 30 miles per hour. Expect a high of 51 degrees. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
A strong front is expected to blow into western Washington tomorrow. The National Weather Service has issued a winter storm warning for the region. Forecasters say it will bring up to 2 feet of snow to the mountains above 2,500 feet on Wednesday. The snow level is expected to drop below 1,000 feet on Thursday.
The Washington State Senate Saturday approved a bill giving state inspectors authority to confiscate raw milk from unlicensed dairies. It was already passed by the House and now goes to Governor Christine Gregoire, who is expected to sign it. An outbreak of E. coli linked to raw milk from an unlicensed dairy in December prompted the measure. 18 people in Washington and Oregon, many of them children, became ill from the milk. The bill makes tougher penalties for breaking milk safety rules and gives state inspectors more authority to halt unlicensed operations. It also requires the Agriculture Department to study how the smallest dairies can satisfy health standards. Raw milk advocate Chris Ostrander, president of the Washington Association of Shareholder Dairy Owners, applauded the study. He also says the bill stigmatizes raw milk by providing special penalties for raw milk producers who run afoul of health rules.
The Washington State House and Senate agreed to create a statewide electronics recycling program on Monday. The program will be paid for by manufacturers of computers and television sets. Democratic Senator Craig Pridemore from Vancouver said the bill was the result of a year and a half of work by local governments, manufacturers, environmentalists, and nonprofit organizations like Goodwill Industries. Manufacturers will pay for the collection, transportation, and recycling of the electronics instead of consumers, something that such companies as Panasonic, Sony, and Sharp lobbied for. The bill requires manufacturers who sell their electronics in Washington to create their own recycling programs or to take part in a statewide system that will establish collecting sites and create other mechanisms necessary for recycling. Washington now sits among Maine and California as the only states in the country with a recycle program specifically designed for electronics like computers and televisions.
Orca whales sighted in South Puget Sound this week are rarely seen anywhere in the Sound this time of year. 16 orcas were spotted around Whidbey and Kamano Islands on Sunday and Monday, according to Orca Network, a Whidbey Island-based nonprofit whale sighting organization. The presence of the whales is unexplained since there is no major run of salmon or steelhead to attract them, according to Fish and Wildlife officials. The whales, on the federal and state endangered species list, were spread out and changing directions, which indicates they were feeding. One of the factors in the orca population decline is the long-term decline in salmon populations. The whales may be expanding their range in search of food.
Federal regulators are considering an unprecedented ocean fishing ban on Klamath River-bound Chinook salmon along 700 miles of Oregon and California coast. The entire Pacific Coast salmon fishing industry from California to Seattle is suffering from a devastated fish run this year. In Oregon and California, commercial fishermen blame the Bush administration for managing the Klamath River in a way they contend favors farmers, dam operators, and timber companies at the expense of fish. The U.S. Interior Department calls the potential fishing curtailment devastating news, but defends the Bush administration's stewardship of the Klamath. In 2002, the Klamath River suffered a massive die-off of returning adult Chinook. By some counts, more than 7,000 fish rotted on the banks. Biologists say in spring of 2002 and again the next year, more than 80% of the juvenile fish returning to sea from the Klamath succumbed to a parasite scientists blame on a combination of low river flows, pollution, and warmer water.
A hearing in Salem yesterday giving the public a chance to give feedback on their police department turned into a, quote, love-in, according to the Salem Statesman Journal newspaper. Salem Mayor Janet Taylor opened the public comment session with praise of the agency's work against methamphetamine-related crime, which was followed by dozens of other city officials and dignitaries offering positive comments and accolades. Held during a time of day when many people were at work, the event attracted only one negative speaker. The Statesman Journal reported that the dissenting speaker was the only participant who didn't have ties to the Salem police. A team of evaluators from the Commission on Accreditation for Law Enforcement Agencies is in Salem to judge the police department on law enforcement standards.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 7, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Angela Hancock Revis. Tonight's audio editor is Margot Considine. Special thanks to reporters Sheila Whiteside and Lisa Leving. Our engineer is Judy Feistel. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Leving. I'm Doug Guidi.
And I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, it's International Women's Day with programs by and about women all day long. At 7:30, Crystal and Ani discuss news about women and the history of International Women's Day. At 8:30, hear about women shipyard workers in World War II. At 9, the topic is labor and Mexican women, followed by a music break with Gloria and Yvonne. At 11:30, hear a special rebroadcast of an interview with actress and activist Margaret Cho. And stay tuned for more women-powered programming through the middle of the night. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, March 7, 2006. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee holds hearings on a new controversial nomination to the U.S. Agency for International Development. Thousands of demonstrators pour onto the streets of France to demonstrate against the government's employment policy. And what is Afghanistan really like after the U.S. invasion and occupation? We'll speak with Afghan Member of Parliament Malalai Joya.
Please force the U.S. government and U.S. allies countries that please stop the supporting of the warlords in Afghanistan.
All that and more after the headlines.
I'm Sharon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. A series of explosions in the Indian holy city of Varanasi is believed to have killed at least 15 people and injured dozens more. Binu Alex reports.
The first blast came at around 6 p.m. local time as hundreds of devotees were gathering outside a temple for their Tuesday prayer. Two more explosions followed minutes later at a train station, one in a moving train. Police have reportedly defused another near the temple where the first blast occurred. Varanasi in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh is a major pilgrimage destination for Hindus in India. Such incidents in the past have triggered nationwide sectarian violence. The explosions came days after Muslims and Hindus battled each other in the nearby city of Lucknow, protesting the visit of the American president in India. No one has claimed responsibility for today's blast. The government has appealed for calm and put some important religious sites on high alert. From Ahmedabad in India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Former Enron Chief Financial Officer Andy Fastow is on the stand today in Houston in the ongoing trial of the company's former CEO Jeff Skilling and ex-chairman Ken Lay. Lisa Cohen reports from Houston.
In courtroom testimony today, Enron's ex-CFO Andy Fastow described his role in setting up and controlling the off-balance sheet LJM partnerships that removed losses from Enron's financial records and helped the company fabricate quarterly earnings. Fastow testified that Skilling told him, quote, "Get me as much of that juice as you can." Fastow has already forfeited $24 million and has agreed to a 10-year sentence if he is deemed to have cooperated in testimony. Skilling and Lay could each face life in prison. From the Enron trial, I'm Lisa Cohen for KPFT in Houston.
Bolivian President Evo Morales has announced a call to elect delegates for an assembly to rewrite the country's constitution. Dileta Varlese reports from La Paz.
The formation of a constitutional assembly has been a key demand of Bolivia's social movement since massive protests outside former President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada in October 2003. The assembly's aim is to draft a new constitution with the participation of sectors that were excluded from having a say in the current constitution. The assembly will be made up of 255 delegates elected on the 2nd of July. The delegates will begin work on the 6th of August in Sucre, the constitutional capital. President Morales today announced the start of a voter registration campaign for citizens who lack papers. Simultaneous election will also be held for a regional autonomy. For Free Speech Radio News, Diletta Varlese, in La Paz, Bolivia.
Talks with the Guatemalan government over the country's mining policy have been called off by the head of the civil society negotiating team. Joe Replego reports from Guatemala City.
Guatemalan Bishop Alvaro Ramassini called off talks with the government yesterday over a new mining bill presented by the Guatemalan Ministry of Energy and Mines. Ramassini, who is the Bishop of San Marcos Province in northwestern Guatemala, said the bill doesn't include key points agreed upon during negotiations with the commission that he leads. The commission was formed to negotiate a mining reform policy with the government after violent protests against a Canadian-owned gold mine in San Marcos led to one death in early January last year. The commission includes representatives from the Catholic Church, academic institutions, and environmental organizations. Key demands of the commission include increased royalties for Guatemala for mining operations in its territory and recognition of local communities' right to decide whether they want mining to take place on their land. The commission also demands that the government place a temporary legal moratorium on all mining permits for metals. Ramassini said talks could be resumed if the government agrees to modify the mining reform bill and send a separate moratorium bill to Congress. If not, the commission will present a bill of its own. Jill Replogle, FSRN, Guatemala.
Farmers at the nation's largest urban garden have received an extension on their eviction notice. The South Central farmers in Los Angeles were facing eviction at midnight tonight. A Superior Court judge has extended the pending eviction date until after a scheduled hearing next Monday. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Low-income energy assistance legislation is receiving overwhelming support in the Senate, but it's also become a battle between geographic regions. Several Republican senators are at odds over which states will receive a limited amount of funding that will provide assistance for people to pay their home heating or home air conditioning bills. Liam Caldwell has more from Capitol Hill.
This is being called a mild winter. But for those who live in New England or the Midwest, the winter rarely seems mild. And for those who can't afford to pay their heating bills, the winter seems longer and colder. A federal program called LIHEAP, or the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, was created to assist the low-income with their home energy costs. $2 billion has been spent on the program so far this year, about the same amount as last year. But it falls far short. Republican Senator Olympia Snow from Maine.
With 30% to 50% increases in their energy bills, and that's in addition to the increases that occurred last year, there was a 20% to 30%. My constituents in the state of Maine cannot meet those rising prices.
So Senator Snow proposed legislation that would take a $1 billion advancement from next year's LIHEAP money. That money will give assistance to more families in need this year. 25% of the money would be distributed to all 50 states. The other 75% would be placed in a contingency fund or an emergency fund to help people pay this winter's heating bills. The Senate has shown overwhelming support for allocating this money, but some are displeased with the process. Republican Senator John Kyle from Arizona.
In the past, however, the way that the money is distributed, it virtually all goes to the people in the colder states, with nothing left over for those folks that have to rely upon air conditioning.
For those who live in warm weather states, summers can be severely hot, especially for those who cannot afford to pay their air conditioning bills. So Senator Kyle offered a plan to change the way money is allocated. He says the contingency fund should be done away with. The entire $1 billion should be distributed proportionally to each state. But Senator Snow and other cold state supporters say doing away with contingency funding sets a dangerous precedent in instances of an emergency.
We have no way of predicting when they might arise. Therefore, it's important to have those funds set aside for exactly and precisely that purpose.
It provides assistance during the summer months to low-income families living in the hot areas of the country.
Republican Senator Susan Collins, also from Maine, she supports the program as is.
And I think that's appropriate, and I've never opposed that. But the fact is, this time of year, that is not the challenge that we face. The challenge is low-income, is assisting low-income and elderly constituents in cold weather states.
Yeah, that's the problem is that if we do the money now through this, what Senator Snow wants to do, is that the money will get spent in the cold weather states, and then there won't be money there for the warm weather states. And that's what always happens, and that's why we have a problem with the way that the money is distributed.
That was Republican Senator John Ensign from Nevada. He is trying to change the way money is allocated. Last year, 32 million people needed LIHEAP funding. Only 5 million received it. This year, applications increased by 13%. David Fox of the Campaign for Home Energy Assistance says the way to easily pass a plan is to fully fund the program.
What it boils down to is it is patently unfair to take money away from a retiree who needs to have protection from cold weather in Maine, for example, in order to provide money to a retiree, say, living in Arizona, that needs assistance to deal with summer heat.
Full funding of LIHEAP is estimated at $5 billion. Fox said that historically, Democrats have tended to support LIHEAP, and the program is becoming more popular among Republican lawmakers. That is shown in their debate on how and who receives funding. Additionally, 34 governors backed a proposal to urge full funding, and a draft letter is being passed around the House of Representatives, which is signed by a large number of both Democrats and Republicans, urging House leaders to fund the program. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The Senate Committee on Foreign Relations is holding hearings today on the nomination of Randall Tobias to head the U.S. Agency for International Development. Some women's rights and public health groups oppose his nomination because they're worried he'll use humanitarian aid as a foreign policy tool. Marcel Hopkins reports.
For the past 3 years, Randall Tobias has served as the head of the federal agency that distributes $15 billion for HIV/AIDS programs. Asia Russell of the AIDS activist group Health Global Action Project says he has not done such a good job.
Tobias has been willing to put ideology ahead of best practice and science when it comes to prevention and treatment.
As an example, Russell cites the Bush administration's abstinence-only policy. It requires HIV educators to promote abstinence until marriage exclusively and prohibits them from promoting condom use. Russell says even though scientific research has shown that condoms can prevent HIV transmission, Tobias argues that they're not effective.
Tobias is not dumb. He knows what the literature and what the data say, and they say something different than the political line that he has often taken at the goading of the Bush administration.
Ellen Marshall, who works with the International Women's Health Coalition, says she's concerned that if Tobias is confirmed as head of USAID, he'll apply a political agenda to all international development programs.
Some of the policies that they've put in place related to HIV might be expanded to a broader set of programs that would come under his leadership at USAID.
But some advocates think Tobias's track record with the government's AIDS programs has proved him to be a good manager. Jove Oliver of the anti-poverty group Results says Tobias made AIDS funding more efficient and effective.
It's been a hard process to do again because you had about five different agencies or six different agencies in the federal government that were working on providing some type of money or some type of assistance for HIV/AIDS. And he has done organizationally a very good job of bringing those five under one roof, kind of, and kind of streamlining what they're doing.
After hearings in the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, the Senate will vote to accept or reject Tobias's nomination to head USAID. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marcel Hopkins.
The United Nations is condemning the murder of an Afghan development worker killed over the weekend in Afghanistan's Farah province. Mohammed Hashim worked rebuilding villages as part of the UN Human Settlements Program. While basic needs like food and water are still scarce in some parts of the country, safety risks remain high, particularly outside the capital city of Kabul. We're joined in studio by Malalai Joya, member of the Afghan parliament who represents the Farah province. After September 11, the United States media led many people in this country to believe that the U.S. military would go to Afghanistan and somehow liberate people, in particular women. 4 years after the invasion, what is the situation there like, not only for women, but for everyday people in Afghanistan? Have there been any fundamental changes?
Yeah, it's good that, for example, after the destroying the domination of Taliban, now we have a constitutional in Afghanistan. For example, we spend presidential election in Afghanistan and also parliamentary election in Afghanistan. Now some women in Kabul, they have liberation. For example, they are going to offices, they can have jobs, they can go outside from burqa. And also there's some security in Kabul and some good life for people. But we should compare, see that the faraway provinces that there is no human rights, no woman rights, no security in the faraway provinces, and our people more than water and food now they need to security. For example, their children in this situation they are kidnapping, and also women they do not have good condition of life. For example, maybe you heard about Amina that in Badakhshan she has been killed by stone by local warlords, and also maybe you heard about about Rahima, 13-year-old Rahima, that in this situation he became raped by groups of local warlords, but nobody asked. And also maybe you heard about Nadia Anjuman. She has been killed by her husband in Herat, when also lots of women in the western provinces of Afghanistan, they commit suicide. I think it's not easy. It's a kind of sacrifice that our women, they are doing. And also most of them, because of security, they have to wear burqa, and they do not trust on the local warlords that they did their test before, and now they are in power. And maybe now, during these days, I received another report that in the last month, two women in Balkh, they commit suicide. Why? And this is the situation of women in Afghanistan. This is the reasons that we are telling that there is no fundamental change in Afghanistan. Not only no security for people of Afghanistan, there is no security even for foreign supporters when they are coming in Afghanistan. So there is lots of facts that I want to tell you, that this is the main reason that there is no fundamental change in Afghanistan. It's true that there are some positive change. Of course, they want to show that we bring just security, we bring democracy and like this. But now our people really, they have suspicions on this kind of democracy that U.S. and U.S. allies, they brought for our people, and they have suspicions on this kind of war on terrorism.
Malalai Joya, you are currently on a speaking tour in the United States and have said that when you return to Afghanistan, you might be tortured or murdered and that you're ready to die for democracy. For people in the United States that are concerned with democracy and human rights, how can they best support the people of Afghanistan?
My main message is this, that please do not forget people of Afghanistan. Especially I want to tell to those freedom-loving people in countries that they want to bring security and democracy in our country. But I know that U.S. and U.S. allies, now they have, right now they have main role in the situation of Afghanistan. Please force the U.S. government and U.S. allies countries that please stop the supporting of the warlords in Afghanistan, support of every kind of warlords, especially Northern Alliance, those people that now they are in power.
Malalai Joya is an Afghan member of parliament. She is currently in the U.S. on a speaking tour. For more information, you can log on to AfghanWomen'sMission.org. That's AfghanWomen'sMission.org. French labor unions brought hundreds of thousands of demonstrators onto the streets of more than 160 towns and cities today in a second day of protests against the government's employment policy. The focus of their anger has been a new type of contract for young workers, which deprives them of current legal employment protection for 2 years. Tony Cross reports from Paris.
Boisterous delegations of school and university students led all the demonstrations, with grizzled trade unionists meekly following behind. Today's protest focused on the right-wing government's new first job contract. At present, a worker can't be fired without compensation, except in very serious cases, for the duration of his or her contract. The new youth contract will last for 2 years, but bosses will be able to fire employees any time they please. Thomas and Samir are at school in the outskirts of Paris. Both of them have elder brothers who have found jobs in information technology. They don't think they would have done so well under the new conditions.
For example, after a year, if they didn't need him anymore, they would have fired him easily. But as it was, he had a stable job after 3 months. He had 3 months slaving away, but in the end, he got it. But with this first job contract, we'll never get there.
If this contract had existed 8 years ago, I don't think my brother would be in the situation he's in now. I think that they would have looked at his racial origins and things like that, and it wouldn't have worked out the same at all.
Gilles, who's an activist with the Force Ouvrière Union Federation, works in the state-run adult employment training scheme, mostly with victims of downsizing.
How can you explain that people who have acquired skills which enable them to do what the company asks them to do, how can you accept they're fired just like that, without notice and without appeal? Today, a young person who's been taken on for 2 years can be shown the door after just an hour, even if he's proved he can do the job. What's that mean? Where are we going?
The government points to unemployment rates in the U.S. and Britain, which are under half that of France, and claims the French labor market is too rigid. Marc is one of a group of temporary teachers in the Paris region who have lost their jobs in a cost-cutting exercise. He says change shouldn't have to be so brutal.
I think that their employment policy is designed to bring in instability along the lines of the English or American model, so that everybody has a job. No job must be safe. I think there must be a third way. That's to say, give everyone secure employment without making people unemployed.
Today's protests were bigger than last month's day of action, with unions claiming a turnout of over 780,000. Students at dozens of universities have been on strike since the beginning of the week, and some workers joined them today. Nevertheless, the government plans to push the legislation through tomorrow. Unions say they'll meet soon to plan more protest action. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
Controversy remains high over the threat that the revised Patriot Act poses to civil liberties. Last week, the Senate voted 89-10 to renew expiring portions of the act that included new privacy protections. But aside from civil liberties, the bill is also posing questions over parts that some say have nothing to do with fighting terrorism, including a provision to combat the use of methamphetamines by requiring drug stores to sell certain non-prescription drugs behind the counter. Selena Masuda has more from D.C.
By as early as next month, hundreds of cold, allergy, and sinus medicines containing pseudoephedrine and ephedrine, the main ingredients used to make methamphetamines, may no longer be sold over-the-counter in the U.S. The U.S. House of Representatives is expected to vote Tuesday afternoon on the reauthorization of the USA Patriot Act, which includes an anti-meth manufacturing measure. Supporters of the provision, like Andrew Kessler of the National Association for Addiction Professionals, see this as an important first step in dealing with what he calls an epidemic.
We believe that by cutting off the supply, it's a good first step. It would make the jobs of the police and the federal agents that go after methamphetamine labs much easier, which they deserve. But the problem won't simply go away because the supply goes away. So as the problem continues, we'd like to see prevention and treatment programs continue to grow, continue to be funded by both the federal government and by state governments and counties and communities around the country.
The bipartisan provision will also require purchasers to show identification and sign a logbook, as well as limit the amount of medicine one consumer can buy. Critics like Doug McVeigh of the Common Sense for Drug Policy say that the anti-meth legislation is a publicity stunt, and the small supply of meth that could possibly cut from the implementation of the legislation will not address the demand.
What really happens in every single state that has imposed restrictions on pseudoephedrine-containing allergy medications, while it is true that they have seen a reduction in the number of labs, that reduction has not been accompanied by a reduction in the level of use. If anything, the use is as high and more dangerous because they're using a more powerful product, ICE, the smokable form.
Other revisions to the Patriot Act include the removal of a provision that required persons to provide the FBI with the name of attorneys consulted regarding a national security letter. The Patriot Act now also provides greater judicial review of gag orders and exempts most libraries from handing over records. The bill is expected to pass in the House. Selena Masuda, FSRN, in Washington, D.C.
The South American country of Chile is awash with new military equipment. F-16s soar over Santiago's skies while submarines patrol the neighboring seas. With new fighter jets, a new surface fleet for the Navy, new army tanks for the Army, and new attack and transport helicopters for all three branches of the armed forces, some neighboring countries are worried that Chile may be in the midst of an arms race. But the government argues that it is simply modernizing every government service, including the armed forces. FSRN's Jorge Garretón reports from Chile, where outgoing President Ricardo Lagos welcomed the first two of 10 fighter jets, but maintains his neighbors have nothing to fear.
These two jet fighters are the first of 10 that will arrive in the course of the year. They will be joined by 18 used F-16s purchased from Holland, new jet fighters, a new surface fleet for the Navy, new tanks for the Army, and later, new attack and transport helicopters for all three branches of the military. So by the end of this year, Chile will have the most advanced military in the region. The government argues Chile is modernizing every structure of the state, and that includes modernizing the military. President Lagos says the government has taken care of all areas of government services, particularly delivery of services to those more in need. He says that now is a time for the military to renew and modernize, but cautions not beyond the country's needs, and the neighbors have nothing to fear.
The important thing is that we have to move forward within the region towards greater transparency in the purchase of military equipment. We are not breaking the region's military balance, and on the contrary, we are maintaining that military balance. But our countries have other more pressing priorities that we have to attend to, and we have done so over the years.
But there has been little debate to the weapons purchased because the military has financial independence. By law, all three branches get 10% of all copper sales from Chile's copper mining giant Codelco. And at the historic price of copper, it has left the military flush with cash. So there's little or no debate in civil society and in Congress to the real needs of the armed forces. Civil society groups do not question the military's capacity to spend billions of dollars on military equipment. One of the few dissenting voices in civil society is that of analyst Raul Sor, who questions the need to purchase weapons that go beyond the country's perceived risk and laments a lack of debate on military needs.
Certainly, if there would have been a larger debate and they wouldn't have been, they wouldn't be able to have this money disposable, probably the purchases would have been less significant than they have.
The major weapons purchases have raised fears in Peru and Bolivia. The concerns of Chile's northern neighbors stem from history. Twice in the 19th century, Chile went to war against the Peru-Bolivia alliance. And in the War of the Pacific, Chile conquered territories from both countries, leaving Bolivia without access to the Pacific Ocean, and Peru lost its southern provinces. Armin Kujumjan, a Chile-based country risk analyst for United Kingdom publication, discounts fears of an arms race in the region, and neighboring concerns ring hollow.
The complaints of the neighbors have a mixture of course, nationalistic fears, but at the same time, I would say type of jealousy, because they all had the same problem of replacement, and Chile, because of its financial political situation, is managing to do what they are unable to do themselves.
Chile's military equipment renewal replaces obsolete equipment, and it is not buying beyond the current stock, so the size of the armed forces remains. According to the government, the country has taken every step to assure neighbors the replacement stock is transparent and that Chile will continue to play a constructive role in strengthening the relationship with its neighbors, particularly with its two northern neighbors, Peru and Bolivia. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Leon Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Jade Paget-Seekins, Eric Klein, and Antonio Ortiz. For archives of this or any other FSRN newscast or documentary, you can check out our website at fsrn.org. You can also email us at comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.
This is Independent Native News for Tuesday, March 7th, 2006. I'm Robert Hannon, in for Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. A federal appeals court in St. Louis has dismissed a lawsuit challenging the tribal elections of the Sac and Fox Tribe of the Mississippi of Iowa back in 2003. Pat Blank reports.
The lawsuit stems from a power struggle that began 3 years ago when the Sac and Fox Tribe of the Mississippi, also known as the Meskwaki Tribal Council, and its chair, Alex Walker, were ousted by a second set of leaders. The infighting led to a seven-month shutdown of the tribe's lucrative Central Iowa casino. The dispute was settled after a series of elections overseen by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. In briefs filed in the appeals court, Walker's supporters suggested that the BIA may have been influenced by controversial lobbyist Jack Abramoff, who'd been hired by the other side. Abramoff made headlines in recent weeks by pleading guilty to influence peddling. In a 7-page ruling from the court, the 3-member panel made no mention of Abramoff, instead saying that the power struggle was a tribal matter that should have been settled by the tribe's own leaders. It's unclear if this is the end of the legal action or if the matter will be taken to the U.S. Supreme Court. Reporting from Cedar Falls, Iowa, this is Pat Blank.
The Winter Olympic Games may be over, but the competition for hosting the 2009 Special Olympic Winter Games is heating up, and Nevada's Native Americans are giving that state a boost in its bid to host the contests. The proposal includes multiple venues in Reno and Tahoe. The games could inject $40 to $50 million into Nevada's economy. Jim VandenHeuvel with Nevada's Commission on Sports says Native American support could make all the difference, just as it did in Vancouver, which will host the Olympic Games in 2010.
When you have a very large population of Indigenous Americans, in this case Indigenous Canadians, that it was a very important factor in the public awareness and the public support component of the bid.
Reno Sparks Indian Colony Chairman Arlen Melendez says the games put an emphasis on including Indigenous people in the process.
It's broader than just the competition itself. It's actually in the spirit of inclusiveness. I think they want to make sure that the Indigenous peoples are represented in any Olympic Games.
Nevada's bid was mailed off on Friday as one of 4 finalists for the 2009 Special Olympic Winter Games. Members of the site selection committee will tour Reno and Tahoe before they make their final decisions. Meanwhile, in northwestern Wisconsin, construction on a giant electric line has been halted by a mother bear and her cubs. If the electric line is built, it will carry electricity from Cree territory in Manitoba to Chicago. Since a hibernating bear's den was discovered a few weeks ago, the American Transmission Company and Wisconsin Public Service Corporation say they won't work in the area until late April. But a Bear Cree elder wants to make sure. Nick Vanderpie from Superior Broadcast Network has the story.
Betty Jack is from Lac de Flambeau, or in the Ojibwa language, Waswaganing. Betty Jack doesn't trust the electric utilities to leave the bears alone.
And it's very important, you know, that these bears be allowed to finish their journey into the spirit world and come back, you know, and join with the life that they have brought to planet Earth. They brought the cubs there here, and the mother bear gives birth to the cubs while she's in the spirit world. You know, and then when she comes back, she bonds with her little babies and carries on her lifestyle here. And a lot of people don't understand that we need to protect that right for people like the bears to live, you know. They're part of us.
There's going to be a ceremony for the bears on Saturday, March 11th. I'm Nick Vanderpie in Lac de Flambeau.
For Independent Native News, I'm Robert Hannon.
Supported by Ridolfi Incorporated, engineers and scientists concerned with the earth, RIDOLFI.com. And by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a multi-regional, multi-tribal federal corporation serving Indian Country, Amerind-Corp.org. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of
Kansas. KABU celebrates International Women's Day on March 8th with 24 hours of programming by and about women.
To be a woman is a lot of different things. I think these are all things I've realized in my adult life. But for a long time, I didn't want to be a woman. I didn't want to identify as a woman. And I think I've always associated it with powerlessness and weakness.
In the years since Margaret Cho first started doing stand-up comedy at age 16, she herself has become a role model for many. And she has done so on her own terms. Her work has given voice and validity to experiences that do not conform to straight white norms.
KABU celebrates International Women's Day on March 8th with 24 hours of programming by and about women.
Women's Voices from Iraq, on Friday, March 10th, 6 to 7 p.m. Tune in to Bread and Roses to hear members of the Iraqi women's delegation, who are now touring the United States. We'll also get updates from local military families actively opposing the war. Friday, March 10th, 6 to 7 p.m. on Bread and Roses.